Welcome once again to our discussions on Keep Holy the Lord's Day, that the Lord's Day might keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. And our guest again is Ron Eldred, professor of religion and world history at John Paul II Catholic High, located on St. Patrick's campus here in at 19th and Poplar. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus of St. Patrick's Church. We've been discussing this is the 15th session now, about Mass, the Mass as a sacrifice, the Old and the New Covenants, the meaning of the Eucharist, particularly the sixth chapter of St. John called the Bread of Life chapter, or the preview of a year later when the Last Supper is enacted by Jesus and fulfilled. So right now we're up to the Last Supper, how Jesus actually offered the Last Supper in that upper room in Jerusalem with his 12 apostles on Holy Thursday night, the night before he dies. And of course, the Last Supper, as we've talked about so often, is the reenactment, the representation of the Last Supper made present among us when we come to keep holy the Lord's Day. So, Ron, welcome back again. And since the Mass makes present the Last Supper of Jesus, or the meal he had with his apostles before he died the next day on Good Friday, how did Jesus say or offer the first Mass?
The Passover or Seder meal or supper that Jesus ate with his apostles at the Last Supper in the upper room had an established liturgical pattern. In other words, he didn't just make it up. They just didn't sit down and eat. It was a very unique liturgy.
Festive, yes, ritual meal.
Right, it was a liturgy, actually. And historians tell us that the Passover liturgy in Jesus' time, just as it is today, I understand anyway, is based on four stages. The four stages of the Passover meal revolve around four cups of wine that were consumed by the participants at different times during the meal or during the supper. I understand that the first stage or preliminary chorus consisted of a blessing called the Kaddush, which was a prayer spoken by the celebrant over the first cup of wine. I believe the celebrant was usually the father or the grandfather of the family, at least certainly an elder. But in the case of the Last Supper, of course, Jesus was not the oldest, no doubt. He himself at the time would have been no more than 33 or so. And we don't know who was the oldest, but probably men in their late 40s or early 30s. Among the apostles. So, but nonetheless, Jesus was their leader, so he would have been the one who would have led the liturgy.
Passover supper.
The Passover supper, yes. This was followed by passing around a dish of green bitter herbs along with a fruit sauce that was shared by all of the participants. The first cup of wine, the Kaddush cup, was the blessing of the festival day, and this was sort of like an appetizer, I understand, rich with symbolic meaning.
So we're following ancient rituals.
Yes.
At the time Jesus is celebrating the Passover Supper.
All this was done, this was all prescribed by Moses under God's direction very soon after the Exodus, and this whole Passover meal, exactly who was to do it and how it was to be done and what was to be eaten and how it was to be eaten and, you know, what the liturgy was to be. And this was an old and ancient liturgy. This is something now that was at least 1,250 years old when Christ...
And it was the meal that the Jewish people ate just before the angel of death came upon Egypt, and were to sprinkle the doors with the blood of the lamb and eat unleavened bread because they were in haste. And it was the liberation or the freedom meal that they kept remembering.
And the lamb was probably chosen because it symbolizes, is going to be, it's a type, actually, what we talked about in one of our earlier discussions. that foreshadows or prefigures this much greater event that's to happen later on in the new and everlasting covenant, the new agreement between God and man in the New Testament.
The freedom meal of the New Testament.
Yes, when Christ takes the place of the Passover lamb.
Okay, what about the second cup that's part of this ancient, ancient ritual?
Well, this consisted of a Passover liturgy, which was taken from chapter 12 of the book of Exodus and read by the celebrant. In this case, of course, it would have been Christ himself. This tells the story of the first Passover in Egypt. Then the youngest participant asked the older participant questions about the Exodus. And, you know, we can probably envision that it's John, the beloved disciple, who we understand was no more than maybe 15, 16, 17 years old during that time. Maybe one of the reasons he was considered by Jesus, you know, he was young and he had a special, you know, love for John. John himself refers to himself as the beloved disciple in his gospel, the Gospel of John.
I didn't know he was considered that young.
Well, I've read estimates that he was probably someone in his late teens, maybe.
Is that right?
Very young.
Well, then he would have had special need of kind of guidance.
Yes.
Sure.
So you can envision John, who was probably sitting on one side of him, and probably Peter on the other. Old Judas is down on the end of the table.
Ready to get out.
Ready to get out or whatever. And so you can just envision John, young John, asking these. Now, these are not just any questions. He's not making these questions up. These are questions that are done in according to the rubrics and according to, you know, the liturgical practices of the day. Afterwards, the participants sung Psalm 113, known as the Little Hillel.
Okay.
Hillel is a Hebrew word for praise. And then they shared a second cup of wine. And by a cup, by sharing, I've seen some pictures and what have you. It perhaps was not a goblet like we think of so much. It's more like a bowl, maybe, shape of a bowl. And the wine, of course, would be put in there and then passed around. And keeping in mind, now, the Last Supper was not something that they were setting at a table like we think of. You see a picture of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper, and they're sitting at a table with
like
chairs
we have.
Like we have.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Jews would have had a table no more than maybe a foot off the ground, 18 inches at the very height, the top, and then they would have reclined. They would have sat with their legs crossed, or they would have
on one elbow,
one side or the other,
eating with a hand
that
they weren't leaning on.
Yes,
and that was the way the Romans typically ate. And I think there was a kind of a idea that we are free people too.
Yes,
and that also was a specifically liturgical gesture.
Yes,
and the gospel says, and when they reclined at table, so it's just talking about what you're referring to there, Ron.
It was during this stage at the Passover meal that the participants, that they relived the Exodus experience and renewed their covenant with God. After one of our discussions the other day, we had a little discussion about precisely what that meant. Did the Jews believe that this was more of a memorial that they were thinking about as the Exodus was being read? Or was it something more than just a memorial? Was there somewhat of the aspects that we have as Catholics of the representation, where this event actually became present and they actually were a part of it and lived it?
I think you're going to work on that and
yes,
do some research.
To come to, you know, to a more definitive conclusion.
Sure.
I think it was more than a memorial, but maybe not quite a representation. Well, at this point, the main course began. First, Jesus would have said grace over the unleavened bread, then the roasted lamb, the Passover lamb, which was served along with bitter herbs for the unleavened bread. They would take the bread and dip it into a sauce like sometimes we do.
And it was unleavened, because that was the way they ate in haste when they were coming out, fleeing out of Egypt.
Yes, by leavening, of course, we mean putting yeast in it, and that takes time for it to rise, and they didn't have time to mess around with
just sort of flour and water.
Yeah, just flour and water.
Okay. And that's the same thing we use at Mass today, unleavened bread.
Yes,
in the Roman Rite.
Yes, and that's something the church would not have to do. It's more of a disciplinary kind of practice than certainly not doctrinal as such that it would be a requirement. There, for example, the Eastern Church, if I recall right, they use leavened bread, and the Catholic Church recognizes their consecrated bread as valid and under certain circumstances. Catholics would be allowed to participate in Holy Communion under certain circumstances. But at this point, the celebrant said a prayer, and then Jesus would have said grace over the third cup of wine, which was known as the cup of blessing. And it was probably the third cup that Jesus transformed into his body and blood. And then the cup of blessing was then passed around and shared by all the participants. In other words, it would have been this cup that Jesus would have said, this is the cup of my blood, the blood of the, well, that was added later on, the blood of the new and everlasting covenant, which will shed for you and for many. That was something I think the church added to tell why he had said that. The Passover liturgy was then culminated with the fourth cup of wine, known as the cup of consummation. Consummation means, of course, this is the end. This is the end of the... But it was not passed around immediately, from what I've read. First, the participants were to sing a beautiful song, which was a long hymn consisting of Psalms 114, 115, 116, 117, and 118. And this was known as the Great Hillel.
So really, from 113 to 118, we've got the Hillel or particular Psalms of Praise.
Yes, Psalms of Praise.
Okay.
And ordinarily, when this long hymn was completed, the fourth cup was passed around and then shared. This represented, this whole service represented the renewal of the covenant with God. It signaled the communion between God and his people and among the brothers and sisters who are members of God's family. However, the gospel account says that the third cup was drunk. Jesus said, I shall not drink. But after that, Jesus said, let me quote this, quote, I shall not drink again of the fruit of the vine until I am entering into the kingdom of God. Then they sang the Psalms, end of quote. But instead of saying grace and blessing the consuming cup, the fourth cup, the gospel says they went out into the night. So ordinarily, they would have gone through this liturgy of the fourth cup with the prayers and that kind of thing, but for some reason, they ended it there and then sung probably the Great Hillel, because it says that they sung psalms, I believe, in John's gospel, or maybe Matthew or the others, they sung a psalm or some psalms after the Last Supper, and then they went out into the night.
Okay, since we've been a good discussion on this, how can you summarize what we've talked about here about the Passover meal that was the type of the Last Supper that we now celebrate, or the preparation for the Last Supper that we celebrate in the New Testament?
Well, to summarize what we've just gone through here, that is the account of the Passover meal that Jesus ate with his apostles, there were four cups that represented the structure of the Passover. The first cup of wine, the Kaddush cup, was the blessing of the festival day, that is the Passover, the great Passover, the greatest festival of all, of course, of the Jews, commemorating, of course, their exit out of Egypt about 1,250 years before that. The second cup of wine began at the beginning of the Passover liturgy itself and involved the singing of the Psalm 113, that is the little Hillel.
Okay.
The third cup, the cup of blessing, took place at the actual meal of the unleavened bread and bitter herbs and the roasted Passover lamb. This was the main course, of course. And before the fourth cup was consumed, they sung the great Hillel psalm, that is several of those psalms together, which would obviously probably taken 5 minutes or 5 or 6 minutes anyway. And then ordinarily the fourth cup was passed around and consumed by the participants. And this was the climax of the Passover meal, but for some reason, Jesus and his apostles skipped the fourth cup.
Okay, well, I know there's a lot of discussion about it. Would you want to say a word about why educators or educated scholars guess about why Jesus skipped the fourth cup? Or do we actually know?
Well, originally, you know, we discussed this amongst ourselves, whether to handle this subject or not, and it would take a whole program in itself to do that, and could end up being pretty
still theoretical.
It's so theoretical. We really don't know. I mean, that was never revealed to us why this is true. Scott Hahn, for example, has a thesis that he's put forth on it where he explains it, and it seemed very, very logical to me. Mm-hmm. And but again, that would take far too long to go into his reasoning for it. And as I said, when I read his book called The Lamb's Supper and where he describes this, I thought it made a lot of sense. Still do, really, as far as that's concerned. There have been some scripture scholars and some theologians and other prominent Catholics who have taken him to task for this, mainly not because there's any real theological issue, but because they feel like that he doesn't really have proof that he should have really first presented this to other scripture scholars and other theologians and
get more input
before it was actually published in a book, designed primarily for the general Catholic audience. And I'd have to agree with that, I think.
But in his defense, doesn't he say in the book that this is his educated guess?
Yeah. And he even says that himself, you know, this is, and so I don't see, but the problem is, you know, how people are, they may say educated guess, but then they go and read it and take it as the gospel,
sure.
The gospel truth. And again, as one of our group that we were discussing this matter, he said, but, you know, it's not a major doctrinal issue, so I don't want, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
Well, it just comes up because we are discussing specifically
the
ritual of the four cups of the Passover meal.
Well, Scott Hahn, he attempts to prove his point by referring to Mark 15:23, which describes Jesus' way to Calvary. Some people had offered him some wine mingled with myrrh, which was an opiate or a painkiller, to lessen, you know, his pain, and he refused to drink this at the time, and Scott Hahn, you know, asked the question, why not? Why didn't he drink it? Now, to go on, according to Hahn, as Jesus was nearing the end of his earthly life, he said at one point, "I thirst." So at that time, he was asking, you know, for something to drink, and, you know, something he'd refused up to that time. So Jesus is asking, you know, "I thirst. I'm asking for, you know, something to drink." And so they provide, you know, him a drink with a sponge, which contained a hyssop, if I remember right. They raised it up with a hyssop, a stick.
Reed,
which had been the kind of stick they had used to take the blood and sprinkle it on and, you know, splatter it on the lintel, the top of the door and the doorpost in the night before they left Egypt.
First Passover meal.
Yeah, at the first Passover, but the night before the angel of death passed over and took the firstborn of the Egyptians. And so Jesus, and of course there was a sponge with this sour vinegar, I think, or actually it was wine. It was a cheap wine. The Roman soldiers couldn't afford the fine stuff, you know, the type of wine that the rich or people would drink. So their wine was really sour, and it was like vinegar. It would taste like vinegar. And so they shared some of their wine. Some of these soldiers take some of their wine, dip it in a sponge, put it on a hyssop stick, lift it up to him, and he drank it. And that's what the Bible tells us. And Scott Hahn says this was the fourth cup.
Oh.
Jesus was he expired and died after that. He had commended his spirit to his Father immediately after that. So according to Scott Hahn's thesis is that this was the fourth cup, but that Jesus would not take until he had entered into his Father's kingdom. Well, it was a little bit before he went, so, you know, but we won't quibble over that. But nonetheless, I think it's a good, when I read it, I thought it was a pretty, made a lot of sense, this whole thing about the fourth cup. But,
sure.
But he has been criticized for it because they say, well, the church fathers never said that. They never found that, you know, centuries ago. And so who's Scott Hahn, you know, to do that?
Okay.
I think they're jealous. I think some of them are jealous of his success.
As you mentioned, it's not a real theological problem.
Right, it's not a theological problem.
It's a historical problem of why he didn't drink the fourth cup and if that might be one explanation for it.
And that's one of the reasons we decided not to go into his whole argument, because his argument, he's quoting quite a bit of scripture and different things to prove thesis about the fourth cup.
He's really a gifted guy.
Oh, there's no question about it.
Well, why don't we go with some time that we have left now? Why don't we talk about the Mass, the reenactment of Calvary, the reenactment of the Last Supper, the Passover Supper that we've been discussing? How do we prepare for Mass so we can get the most out of it?
The best thing I ever read on that was a book written by Romano Guardini. He was an Italian, but if I recall right, I think he lived much of his life in Germany. But he was a very prominent theologian in the church in the 1920s and 30s. There were some others, the names that come to mind, who were contemporaries. When you think of Guardini, you also think of Louis Boyer, who was a Protestant Huguenot, Calvinist, a French Calvinist who had converted to the Catholic faith and became one of the church's great theologians in the 30s and 40s, and then also Carl Adam, who was a German theologian of great prominence during that time. These men had a lot of influence. Guardini had a lot of influence on people like De Lubach and Balthasar, some of the great theologians of the 1950s.
Who greatly influenced the council.
Yeah, who greatly influenced the council, in fact, and they in turn had a great deal of influence on John Paul and Benedict XVI. Guardini has a book where he talks about the Mass and how to prepare for it and all that kind of thing. And so a lot of the things that we're going to be presenting here to our listeners have come from Guardini, Romano Guardini. But before we celebrate Mass, I think we should properly prepare ourselves. That's
and this is what Guardini especially is saying.
That's what he's saying.
Okay.
That the Mass, the holy sacrifice of the Mass, is a sacred event celebrated in a sacred place. Therefore, we should dress and act appropriately, and not as if though we were going to the beach or to attend an athletic event or to play a sport. We should dress appropriately for the celebration of the Mass, which used to be, one Sunday best.
Okay.
Used to hear that all the time, one Sunday best, dressing up in a suit and tie, probably, back in those days. The way we dress, and I don't think there's any doubt about it, the way we dress expresses our attitude toward God and His sacraments. And moreover, the way we behave before and during the celebration will determine whether or not we are merely going to be spectators or whether we're going to be participants. A spectator is someone who's a part of an audience or a part of a crowd who they may have their attention focused on something, but they're not participating. You go to an athletic contest, and those who sit back in the stands or sit to whatever, they're certainly not participants. They're just simply spectators. And when we go to Mass, we're supposed to be more than just spectators. We're supposed to participate.
It's we're supposed to be offering ourselves with Jesus at the altar. Okay, why is Guardini so stressing kind of these externals? And many people say, oh, well, externals don't make that much difference. He's trying to say prepare our mind and heart, and externals do make a difference.
Well, you'll hear people who will say, it doesn't matter how you dress when you go to Mass. It's what's in your mind, what's in your heart, and that kind of thing. Well, there's some truth to that. But your posture, the way you dress, all these kind of things, though, does have a relationship in terms of respect and reverence and attitude and a frame of mind and these kind of things that make it better for us, conditions for us to participate in the holy sacrifice of the Mass.
I think the church has always made an effort with decorations, the way the church is to be clean and presentable, and the flowers that they're used during Easter, or not using flowers during Lent, the penitential time. All the externals can play a big part in sort of getting us into the spirit of what we're celebrating at that time.
Yes.
Okay, well, so you referred to Guardini's book.
Yes, Guardini identifies three things, including recollection, three things that are necessary to properly participate in Mass. And first is that we have to be present and aware of what's going on in the Mass. So we must become recollected, and we're going to talk about recollected and explain what that is.
Okay.
We have to be still, and so we'll discuss that. And then we have to be silent. Well, that a lot of people confuse stillness with according to Guardini, they confuse stillness with silence, but they're different things. By stillness, he just simply means not moving around all over the place, being as physically quiet as we can.
Well, he's not referring so much to talking than speaking.
He uses silence for not talking.
Not himself, talking.
Or only talking at the right time.
Okay.
And so there are three things. Again, there's what we call recollection. There's what's called stillness and what is called silence. So those are the three things that are necessary to do and do well to, you know, better participate in Mass. And the better we participate, the more we're going to get out of it.
Well, let's take them individually then, because I sort of just automatically identify being recollected, be still, and be quiet as pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, all kind of fused. And basically, I had done the same thing until, you know, I read his book and and really studied it very carefully. And
Can we say a few words about recollection? We've got a couple of minutes yet.
Well, before we can fully participate in Mass, we must learn to free ourselves from attractions or distractions. From without, that outside of ourselves, and then on the other end, the turmoil that's within us. And in the parlance of a generation ago, one must become calm, cool, and collected.
Within as well as without?
Yes, without.
Okay.
The calming of the self is called composure or recollection. And recollection means collecting the scattered self and returning to the center of one's being. Now, that's kind of philosophical, and I don't want to get into a lot of discussion of that, but let me repeat that. It means collecting the scattered self and returning to the center of one's being.
I think the Quakers call that centering down.
Yes.
It's a whole attitude towards recollecting myself. So thank you for being with us on our discussion, keep holy the Lord's Day, that the Lord's Day can keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. And may God bless you always and in all ways. We hope to be with you again our next session.